All right, folks, welcome back. Welcome to Lecture 51 in this American History program of History at Our House. Today we are going to start into part 4 of the course, which I'm calling The Founding. So we've been studying a lot of the build-up towards American history, and we've been creating a foundational awareness of history in order for us to be able to understand American history. So now that we have that groundwork in place, we're going to be able to make sense of this story that we are going to witness, where America's founders are going to reject a tradition that they are the inheritors of in favor of a new and radical form of government, which has some precedent, but which in certain regards has never been seen before on Earth. And this story is absolutely stellar. I mean, it is the most wonderful step in human progress since ancient Greece and Rome. So it's a really wonderful example of a part of history that is not only important, but good. A part of history where we are studying an aspect of the world that we live in, how it came to be, how it was made, from the perspective of the best thing about it, which is freedom. So it's an amazing story to study. And so we in this class are going to continue to study the anchor facts of this story together. Today, unfortunately, I wasn't able to find the document. I lost it because I'm not at my top best today. So we're going to have to resume that tomorrow after I have recovered the document in question. Other than the ones that we are currently discussing as a group activity, the foundational facts of American history in that setting, we still do have a basic set, which I'm going to share with you now, which is part of the anchor fact timeline. And that anchor fact timeline continues to evolve as we learn new facts. So this is the latest version of it. I've taken the one that we've had before, and I've made a variety of modifications to it so that we start to have room for some of the key information that we are going to be looking forward to, right? And have room for key facts of American history. And Alexander is noting that one of the things that I did with it, he called it, I squeezed it. And yeah, in a way I did squeeze it. And I want to explain this here, because we've been talking about what it is that we do when we study history and how not everything in the past is equally important. In other words, not everything in the past is equally worthy of our attention here in the present. And one of the things that I think is something that I'm learning to do and getting better and better at is learning how to represent the past in a way that captures this fact. So I find that it's very common for timelines, for instance, to be such that every single year it takes up as much of the timeline as every other year. Well, that is another example of the failure to, in typical timelines of history, another example of the failure to recognize that not everything in history is as important as everything else. And so a proper historical timeline, in my view, should actually have a kind of varying time scale depending on how important certain things are. And so, if we want to study American history, it doesn't make sense for our timeline. Even though the unification of Egypt is relevant to our story, it doesn't make sense for our timeline to really kind of have as much room for the 1,000 years after that on it as the 1,000 years that American history is a part of. It just doesn't make sense. It's not as important. So what I've done here is I've compressed the timeline on the left-hand side with those first 4,000 years of history taking up that side of the chart. And then the rest is about two-thirds of the timeline is the last 1,000 years. And in fact, as you can see, the time scale varies constantly. Not constantly, but I mean it varies pretty much over the course of the diagram, because the most important history for us is the most recent. So you'll see that 1900 to 2000 AD, I've left a lot of room for that. We're going to put some stuff in there. It's going to be on our timeline, and that stuff is more important. Right? I mean, whatever American presidents did and things that happened in the 20th century are way more imminently connected to, intimately connected to our lives now than things that happened thousands and thousands of years ago. So this is what I call this a present-centric timeline, because what it does is it captures the importance of things in just by the very way that the time scale is adjusted to indicate how important certain things are. And what you can see on here again, beyond what we've studied in the past, is I've added the Magna Carta. So as a group, we are still studying anchor facts. And as a group, we are going to develop a set of anchor facts that students at the earlier levels are not going to be working with. Because at your age, you're ready for and should be seeking to get kind of a more full-featured, richly detailed awareness of the past, not just the basics. The basics that an 8-year-old can grasp, that's all fine and good for an 8-year-old, which is, and they can do this sort of thing. But you guys are ready for more, and you should be wanting to get more. You should be thinking, yeah, this outline of history that we have, it's nice, and it's useful, and I can remember these anchor facts because I get how important they are. But obviously, history is more than anchor facts, right? So we have a goal. We definitely have a purpose here to develop our awareness as much as we can. We have a more ambitious goal that we are seeking with regard to these facts. So we're going to work on that over the course of the coming weeks, and we're going to start to learn more than what comes after anchor facts. As great as they are, as valuable as they are for studying history, they are not everything. They're not the only method that can help us to see and to retain and to use relevant, significant information about the world around us. So we're going to be taking it to the next level pretty soon here, in fact. Anyway, I will post this timeline for you guys because it's still a good one to have. It gives you the full sweep of history, and it shows you, it reminds you of kind of the basics. So it's a good one to have on your wall. What we're going to focus on today here in the lead up to the American Revolution is precisely, you know, the value of knowing this. The importance of appreciating the English tradition of liberty, and how the English tradition of liberty is the most immediate context for the American Revolution. The American Revolution has three parts to it, three basic parts to it. The first is an argument. So it's not nearly, at first, the American Revolution isn't a revolution at all. It's just a big argument. It's an argument between, it's an escalating argument between the king and his American colonists. And the type of argument that's happening goes back to the Magna Carta. So it's important to understand how that type of argument came to be and what was the essence of it. And what we will see, though, is that in American history, that argument becomes what the founding fathers of America realized was this argument that they're having with the king is a never-ending argument. It's an argument that they'll never permanently win. And they come to realize more clearly than anybody ever before that the only way to win this argument is to get rid of monarchy altogether and to become independent. So that's the second part of the story. The war, the Revolutionary War, and the Declaration of Independence, and that whole assertion of a desire to break with monarchy altogether. That's part two. And then part three is they succeed, and so part three is building a new country. Taking the theory of, and the history, and all the instructive information that the founders are aware of as students of history, and finding a way to apply all that theory to the context of America and make a new country. And then after that, well, once the country exists, you've gotta run it. So all of that is part of the founding. So this is what I call this period, this part four of our story is called the founding, because it's basically the recognition of of the need for a republic and the beginning of the republic. Okay. So let's set the scene using our awareness of some of these anchor facts and recall a little bit, reminder of the context of English liberty in order to get ready for the revolution. So let's go here. Let me get this diagram. Do I have the diagram? Yeah. This is what America had before the revolution. Right? It had a constitutional monarchy. Which is saying what and how did it get it? So, real question now for you guys. Let me for a second. Sorry, Timothy, I'm going to let you answer that. But first, I've got to go back to my meeting center and turn off that annoying noise. Share my screen. Okay, I'm back to the regular. Give me a sec. It's slow today. Okay. Timothy, go ahead.
Means that the king is not above the law, and the reason that they were able to get this constitutional monarchy is when King James, I think it was
King John.
No, King John.
Yep.
They got King John to sign the Magna Carta.
Okay, very good, right? So the American colonists, before the American Revolution, have this form of government called constitutional monarchy, where there is a king, but the power of the king is limited by a set of laws, a constitution. And so the principle of constitutional monarchy, as Timothy puts it, the essence of it is, the king is not above the law. And that was what was asserted here. Hence our new anchor fact, right? Because the Magna Carta is when the English first established this principle, a precedent which then continued to animate their efforts to be free in life. They had the king, they had the law, and well, the thing is, constitutional monarchy by its nature is unstable. It's always a delicate balance. Why? I can diagram it kind of this way. Kind of useful way to think of it sometimes, maybe, is to just kind of think of it like this. Think of constitutional monarchy as a balance. Well, that's not even really touching. I want it to touch. Let me try again. So it's a balance, right? Like this. And so how does that work, Alexander?
Well, the king always wants to get more power, and he always wants to put himself above the law. And the people all want to have to not have a tyrannical king, so they try to put the law always above the king.
Yeah, exactly. So you get this seesaw action through in a constitutional monarchy. You have this, it's a never-ending argument. The kings are always working to tip the balance of power within the state. We could still use that term balance of power, right? In this context, it just means balance of right and authority and power within the government. The kings want more, and the citizens want their rights and freedoms protected from that greater power and that ambitious power of the kings. And so they're always trying to balance this equation out, trying to keep a balance so that the kings can't be tyrannical. All right. And so working our way towards America, we get to a really interesting point. Oops. In the story, I didn't mean to do that. Right. Although I could definitely draw it here, right? With Jamestown and Plymouth, we start to have, that's part of the story of the seesaw in a way. Right? What was it? What did colonization do in the story of English constitutional monarchy? It added a new dimension to the story. It added a new dimension to the argument. How did it change it? For people to come to Jamestown, for people to come to Plymouth, how did that change the story? Alexander?
Well, now you have people really far away from the king on the home country who are still technically under the power of the king, but the king can't really directly do anything about it.
Right, exactly. I mean, they are across the Atlantic Ocean. So they are living their lives in a whole new context, very much separate from the king. And we know that the Plymouth colonists, that was their main purpose, to escape the power of the king. Because back in Europe, what principle was so onerous to them? What was it? Why did they need to escape? Why were they seeking this religious separation? What's the principle that says the king, right, in this balance, the king gets to violate your rights, Juliet?
Q is from you, A is from
the king. Exactly, right? So in Europe, well, there's no argument there. The king does it. But in England, there was a certain expectation. Well, what about, okay, how do we solve the problem with regard to religion? By the time of Plymouth, it hadn't been solved. By the time of Plymouth, there was still no religious freedom in England. So the seesaw was going to go back and forth. And what we're going to get in England is the English Civil War in order to try to deal with this problem, right? And the monarchy will come back. And then when the monarchy comes back, well, they will start to implement religious toleration in England because that's the way that it works. The battle goes back and forth, a tug of war between the two sides, rights versus power, republic versus monarchy. Constitution versus the king. It's always, you know, the two sides are trying to get what they need, what they want the most. And so the Plymouth colonists, though, they left before that was resolved because they didn't see that it was going to be resolved. So they want to be by themselves, have their own Calvinism, their own Puritanism, and be separate from anybody else. The Jamestown colonists are not really trying to escape in the same way, except in a way they are. Could we characterize the Jamestown colony in Virginia as a kind of escape as well, especially in connection to head rights? Can you see how there's a common denominator there? What is the significance of the head rights system in this regard? It's kind of similar to the idea of religious separation. Keen?
The head rights system system, especially if you were not, you know, if you were someone low on the feudal ladder, the headret system allowed you to, you know, get land, which you'd never be able to get in mainland England and all of Europe, really, and really start a new life, escape from your place in the feudal system and try to make your way to a better life if you were low on the ladder.
Exactly. This was freedom of opportunity, right? So it's like all of a sudden, a person who's got no chance to make his life better in England can come and create a much more wonderful life than is possible back in Europe. Yeah, so colonization was very significant in terms of tilting the balance back in favor of the people, back in favor of individuals versus the power of the king. Because as Alexander said, the king is on one side of the ocean, the colonists are on another side of a huge ocean. They are living their lives in a whole new way. They have more land than they could ever have dreamed of having. They get to worship the way they want to worship. There's a lot of new freedoms that they get to enjoy. And so, yeah, colonization is very significant. And we start to see that they're going to make a parliament, the House of Burgesses in Virginia. Pretty soon, you know, people in Plymouth also have their own kind of self-government. It's not as free, but nonetheless, you know, it's far from the king. So there's a tradition growing in the colonies over the entire period of colonization of self-government and of this, of being apart from the king. So the colonial world was very significant in that regard, in this never-ending argument of constitutional monarchy. Well, now we get to the end of that chapter, really. We're right now where we are in our story is right in the transition between that and monarchy, between that and the Declaration of Independence and a republic. Because at the end here, the King of England is starting to tip the balance back in his favor. After the colonial wars, as those are coming to an end, the King of England, or the British King, the King of Britain, right, is becoming more powerful than any king has ever been. The British King now is this imperial master of North America and sundry other islands and territories in the Americas, and also parts of Africa and India. And starting to take over places like Australia and New Zealand. And pretty soon, the King of England is going to be the first monarch that we could genuinely look at as being at the center of the world. The world is becoming Anglo-centric. And this king is getting powerful, and that is seductive. That is corruptive, right? He's going to now crack down on the colonists who just by virtue of being on the other side of the Atlantic, they tip that balance in a way that kings by their nature don't like. And so here today we're going to talk about the very first case of a very first obvious case where this desire for the colonists to continue to be free runs up against this new power of the English king, who is growing in power and who expects to grow in power. And we start to see the birth of the argument. The birth of the argument between the colonists and the king, and the birth that's going to lead eventually, as I said, they're going to think this argument can't be solved unless we get rid of the king altogether. So this argument, let me just get rid... Actually, I can type it on here. This argument is called the Writs of Assistance case, 1761. The Writs of Assistance case of 1761. So you'll hopefully remember that the colonial wars are just coming to an end here, right? The colonial wars will go on until 1763. So they're just coming to an end. Quebec has already been conquered, and so the truth is, you know, England's going to win. It's already very close to being over. And so the king has got more and more power, and he's looking over at the American colonies and he's thinking they're not producing, they're not behaving the way that they're supposed to as subjects. They've cost a lot of money to defend. They've cost a lot of money for us to conquer more territory. And, well, it's time for them to do as they're told. And in particular, in the colonies, there was an aspect of the freedom of the colonists that really irked the king, really irked the British government. And that was that, well, because they were so free, because they were so far away on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean, they would take it upon themselves to pursue their own happiness. How terrible of them. They would pursue their own happiness in the sense that they traded very freely with just about anybody. They traded very freely with each other, members of different colonies. They traded even with people from other European countries if they felt that it was in their best interest. And so there were times when, you know, everybody in different colonies produced different things. You know, that in Virginia they made tobacco. In places like Massachusetts, they would have a lumber industry. They had a lot of different types of products. A lot of them we don't recognize anymore today. But there were a lot of different products produced in the colonies. And we know that the theory of colonization is they're supposed to make stuff, but not freely trade it. Why are they supposed to make tobacco? Why are they supposed to make lumber and so on? Alexander?
So they can sell it to Britain, and then Britain pays them and sort of keeps the money inside the country, assuming that the colonists are part of Britain, sort of.
Exactly. They're an extended part. They're an extended organ of the empire, of the imperial home country, right? So everything kind of stays inside the British system. But what if you want to get stuff from Spain? What if you want to buy stuff from the Spanish colonies? What if you want to buy stuff from the French colonies? Should you be able to do that? What if you need certain food products? What if you need something else that they can provide? Should the government be able to tell you, no, you're not allowed to trade with those people? Well, this was the question that was at the heart of the Writs of Assistance case. Because the American colonists had a tradition of freer trade. And even if there were rules that said, and there were indeed rules that said, you cannot trade freely with other people, they didn't necessarily agree to follow those rules. For instance, some of them were very onerous and very unfair to them. So for instance, there were a set of laws called the Navigation Acts. So it works like this. If you are a colonist, if you live in the colonies, you may only trade, by law, you may only trade with England and on English ships. So, if you, for instance, if the Spanish are going to buy any goods from us, from you, from the colonies, the way that it has to work is this. You and the colonies have to send your product to England and be taxed on that trade by the English king. And then if the Spanish want to buy it, they have to buy it from England, which again will allow the king to tax the trade. Right? So now, if you're an American, what does this add up to? Remember, what do we call that arrangement where somebody kind of sticks themselves in the middle of trade in order to take advantage of trade? What was that called? It was really at the heart of the Age of Discovery. What's that person's role? Let me ask the question. Let me go back a little bit here to make the question easier to answer. Remember, you've got, in the Age of Discovery, you've got, let's say, China, and they've got goods, And, well, those goods are going to India, and then those goods are going to Arabia, then those goods are going to Egypt, and then those goods are going to Italy, and then finally they're making their way to England. What happens along that trail of trade? Every time the goods are purchased and sold, purchased and sold, purchased and sold, what happens? Keen?
The price goes up. The
price goes up. Everybody makes a profit, and that person's role is called the middleman, right? The middleman. And so what England was doing with its navigation acts was it was making it, forcing the colonists to accept the presence of a middleman. Who's the middleman? Who's going to now profit from any trade between the colonists and anybody else in the world? England. The whole purpose of the Navigation Acts was to force the colonists to accept the home country as the middleman. Now, if you are living in Virginia and you want to trade products with your Spanish neighbors in the Caribbean, do you want to buy from them through a middleman or buy from them directly? The whole point, right, here of trading directly is that it's better for you. Why would you want to have a really inefficient process that involves all kinds of taxes? It's very onerous. It doesn't even make sense. You're going to ship your goods to England, and then those goods from England are going to be shipped to Spain, and then Spain will be the middleman and trade with the Caribbean colonies, and the Caribbean colonies will then get their goods, and they'll trade to Spain. Spain will trade back to England, and then England will trade with you and the colonies? Well, that's pretty ludicrous, right? If you're living in Virginia or Georgia, and you want to trade with Cuba, well, they're practically neighbors. You just go directly there, trade with them, you're done. And meanwhile, your life is made a lot better because you don't have middlemen. So Americans faced with onerous restrictions on trade, especially these laws which were called Navigation Acts, they answered that by saying, forget it, we're just going to go trade. We are here, the king's over there. We are just going to ignore these laws or operate outside the law because these laws hurt us. These laws hurt us in the name of the king, in the name of the mother country. They don't. These laws subordinate us to the people of England. These laws are an example of the rights of a citizen being suppressed in the name of the government. So, oftentimes, American colonists did not want to follow these laws. So they would engage in free trade, which, well, when free trade is engaged in against the law, what's that called? See, then the government gets to take over the dictionary. Alexander, go ahead.
Smuggling?
Smuggling, exactly. So free trade against the law is what the government calls smuggling. So American colonists were notorious for smuggling. And the British government was very frustrated by this because the whole point of setting up colonies and having navigation laws was that the home country would benefit. And the colonists were supposed to agree to this notion that they are citizens of the home country, that their lives, the purpose of their lives, is to make life in the home country better, to make the home country more powerful. So what basically was going on here was that, in a way, because of these laws, because of this thought process, it was a new kind of feudalism. To be a colonist meant what? Did you have the same rights as other Englishmen? To be a colonist meant what? You were now expected to live at a lower level. Could you trade with people of another country? No. People of England could. How come you couldn't? Because you're a colonist. What does it mean to be a colonist? Your life is not your own. Who does it belong to? The home country. The whole point of having a colony is not that the colony gets, the people in the colony get to live for themselves, get to pursue their own happiness. What are they supposed to do? They're supposed to live in the service of the home country. So here's the argument. Here's the conflict now in this new setting, in this new context. It's very much a part of this fundamental argument between rights and monarchy. Did colonists have the same rights as everybody else, or were they, people might call that nowadays, second-class citizens? Right? Did they have to accept that they didn't have the same rights as everybody else just because they were colonists? Well, they wanted to smuggle, in a way, to assert their rights. They wanted to trade freely despite the laws, and they did. All the way up until, well, the end of the colonial wars, the British government started to crack down on smuggling. The colonial authorities, on behalf of the king, started to issue what were called writs of assistance. So there's where we get the name. And a writ was a written permission, a written kind of like a charter. A writ was a document that empowered, today what we would call a writ, we'd call it a warrant. What's a warrant? You know, like you see it on legal shows all the time, right? The police show up at the door, and what do people say? And they want in. People say, have you got a warrant? So what's a warrant? Special legal document that empowers the police to act in a certain way, such as to enter your home or to arrest you on suspicion of criminal activity, right? But those things are very, very limited, right? In a republic, in a society of individual rights, the government can't just arrest you whenever it wants. The government has very limited powers in how it must treat you, right? And so warrants nowadays are very, very closely regulated. If the police want to arrest you for something, if they're not seeing you commit a crime right in front of them, right? The police have to go to a judge and they have to make the case that they have evidence against you that warrants you being put under arrest, and they're going to then put on trial and so on, right? So the judge then issues a warrant and that says the police have a right to go and place you under arrest and so on. It's a very, very closely regulated, very, very strict process. And typically the police can't do anything to you unless they're in possession of such a permission from the authorities. Well, writs of assistance were open-ended warrants. Writs of assistance were warrants that basically allowed police officers to enter people's property or businesses purely on general suspicion. Not without specific cause, not with any specific awareness of a crime having been committed. But let's say you're a guy who's got a business and, well, you're doing well. Well, you must be a smuggler. So they could present the writ of assistance and you could have to open your door and they could start to rifle through all your stuff. They could look at your stock, they look at all your books, they could figure out, where did you buy this stuff? Did you get any of this from a colony, or did it come through America? Is it properly stamped? Is it properly labeled? Did it go through was it shipped on an English ship or not? And so on and so forth. Go through all of your belongings, go through your private things in order to see whether or not you were a smuggler. So this was a severe tipping of the balance away from individual rights towards the power of the government. If the government can enter your home whenever it wants, if the government can enter your place of business and go through your stuff whenever it wants, if it has total power like that to invade your private world, that is total slavery. That is, you have no freedom whatsoever, right? You're walking down the street, you can be arrested at random. If the government has this total level of power over you, then it's the opposite of freedom. And so this was a very dangerous thing that the government, in order to crack down on smuggling, was implementing these writs of assistance. And an American lawyer named James Otis, I can type his name up there as well, because he's the first hero of the American Revolution. An American lawyer named James Otis sued the government. And he said, these writs of assistance are illegal. They are unconstitutional. Englishmen have rights, including the right to not be subject to illegal search and seizure by their government. These writs, open-ended warrants, which allows the government to basically invade your life at will, are completely contrary to freedom. So he sued the government in order to stop the writs of assistance. Well, he lost the case. The writs were maintained. And this became the first in a long series of arguments between the colonists and the British monarchy. A long series of arguments as this balance tipped back and forth. Right now it was tipping in this direction. The king and the power of the government was growing, and the colonists were becoming more and more subject to the power, the arbitrary power of their government. Tomorrow, as we pick things up, we'll see it just kept on growing. There was an obvious tendency by the government in Britain to implement laws, more and more of them, to restrict the freedom of the colonists and not to respect their rights of Englishmen. And the question became, how do we get this back? How do we tip this balance back this way? And eventually the realization came that there was no way to do it. And the only way to do it is to become independent. Alrighty, so tomorrow we'll pick things up from there, and we'll get further into this escalating argument between the colonists and the home country. That's it for now. Thank you, everybody. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye-bye.